Chapter 9. Brave New World. Ultimately, man should not ask what the meaning of his life is, but rather must recognize that it is he who is asked. In a word, each man is questioned by life, and he can only answer to life by answering for his own life. To life, he can only respond by being responsible. Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. Several years ago, my family went camping in a place called Mammoth Cave in Kentucky. As part of the trip, my wife informed me, as often happens in our household, that we were going to be making a little side excursion to a place called Horse Cave, where, as she put it, we would engage in a little light rappelling. The reason my wife had to warn me in advance about this little rappelling adventure is that she knows that since well before we were married, I have been afraid of heights. But, she consoled me, it's probably a very short cliff. After all, even our kids, who were much younger at the time, were able to rappel. How bad could it be? And she added, it ends in a pizza buffet. If you want to get me on board with any plan, just tell me it ends at a pizza buffet. The time came for us to make our little side excursion, and as we were gearing up to rappel, I remember thinking, wow, this is a lot of gear we're wearing for a little kid cliff. We had helmets and pads and the kinds of harnesses that you normally see daredevils and soldiers wearing. I started to get nervous as I glanced around the room of 25 or so heavily armored people in our group. Then, I received two pieces of information I did not previously have. The first was that it wasn't, in fact, a little kid cliff, but was instead a sheer 80-foot cliff that emptied out into another 120-foot drop into Horse Cave. I got a little tense. However, the second piece of information held my salvation in its grasp. Our guide informed us that there was now a lightning storm headed into the area, and if the lightning storm came in quicker than expected, there was a good chance that not everyone would be able to go over the cliff. As you can imagine, I developed a new strategy. I was going to be the most polite rappeller in the history of Horse Cave. As we made our way out to the cliff, I was letting every single person in our party ahead of me. No, you go first, please. I really want the experience, but I want it for you more. As we arrived out at the cliff, I was the very last person in line out of approximately 25 people in our group. I was singing praises to my own brilliance. I thought I'd managed to successfully escape having to rappel while simultaneously looking like a really good guy. Then I looked up. At the very front of the line was my 9-year-old daughter, Ava. Her eyes were filled with excitement and she couldn't wait to go over the cliff. Almost as if he was taunting me, our guide put his hand on Ava's helmet and proclaimed, "Look at this brave young lady! How daring and fearless is she to be the first over the cliff? Is there any mere mortal as courageous as she?" Okay, I may have made that last part up. But, he added, "We can't have a child go first. We need an adult to go first." Ava immediately turned and looked right at me. At that moment, a switch flipped in me. I've spent a lot of time in the years since this happened trying to understand what changed, and I believe I've arrived at an answer, which I'll share in a moment. Almost as if having an out-of-body experience, I immediately raised my hand and I said, "I'll go," adding under my breath, "I want to die quickly and with honor." I walked over to the precipice of death, and our guide hooked me in and told me to lean back over the cliff. I felt the line grow taut, and I began down the rock, and I realized that the mechanism was actually holding my weight. In fact, I was enjoying myself. As I got about 15 feet down, almost out of earshot, I heard the guide suddenly proclaim, "Okay, folks, apparently the lightning storm is coming in quicker than we thought." For a moment, I thought I was the butt of a giant cosmic joke. However, his point was that we would need to hurry to get everyone over the cliff, which we did, and it was a great experience, and I might add, the pizza buffet was magnificent. Back to the moment when something flipped in me, and the defining question. Why was I thoroughly terrified to do something one moment, then in the very next moment I found myself willingly doing that very thing? I'll tell you the answer I've come to. It's because I heard my name. Now, no one was shouting Todd Henry. That's not what I mean. You see, I've come to believe that my real name isn't whatever my parents called me. My real name is whatever I choose to respond to. I've learned that all day long, every day, I have names hurled at me by my circumstances. My inner narrator hears things like coward or imposter or incompetent or selfish or failure. However, I've trained myself to spot those narratives as they enter my head because I've learned that more often than not, the narrative or vision that I choose to listen to will be the dominant influencer of my behavior. So, in that moment, instead of responding to the name coward, putting my head down and trying not to make eye contact with our guide, I chose to respond to the name brave. I chose in that moment to live by the narrative that we've taught our kids since a young age that we do hard things. In fact, the likely reason that Ava sped to the front of the line is because since she was young, we've called her Brava to reinforce that she is courageous and doesn't need to be timid. We've reinforced that name for her so her natural response with her life is toward bravery. We each stand at various precipices in our lives, and in those moments, we must choose our identity. Will you be the kind of person who shrinks from the moment, or the one who is willing, even when it's uncomfortable, to do the right thing? Will you not only endure, but embrace discomfort for the sake of the greater good? Will you refuse to rationalize cowardly behavior as an expression of wisdom? Will you respond to the name brave? How do you measure a life? This is a question that innovation theorist Clayton Christensen asked in a fantastic book by the same title. He said that many of his contemporaries from business school had found themselves in jail because, despite their financial success, they didn't set good boundaries for their life and eventually violated common ethical or legal standards. They had not pre-established how much was enough. So when they found themselves with the opportunity to gain a little more, they simply couldn't help themselves. So I ask you the same question. How will you measure your life? In years lived? In experiences? In the amount of money you accumulate? In how others think of you or your reputation in the community? The truth is, you cannot really control any of those things. One unfortunate illness or accident and your years could be cut short unexpectedly due to no fault of your own. Despite your best intent, your health may compromise the quality of the experiences you can genuinely have. While you may chase financial success, any number of forces beyond your control can cause all of that money to slip through your fingers. And despite all the good you may want to do in your community, your reputation and legacy are beyond your ability to control. It will be a story that others tell once you're gone. So, how do you measure a life? I propose a simple answer. In the number of moments in which you overcame cowardice and acted bravely. Those moments of bravery form the shape of your life and also its depth. Perhaps more importantly, they carve meaning into the mountainside of mundanity. When you think back on your life, the moments you will be most proud of are those in which you choose action over apathy, candor over cowardice, and intercession over feigned ignorance. Most people will never see or know about these moments. They are yours alone, and they define your character, which in turn determines your destiny. And in the end, they are the foundation of your life's story. Anthony and his diagnosis. Anthony was a high school teacher in Brunei, on the island of Borneo. While teaching, he was unexpectedly diagnosed with a brain tumor and given a year to live. Wanting to ensure that his young wife wasn't left penniless when he died, he hatched a plan to write and sell a few novels to provide a sum for her to live on after he was gone. In the next year, he worked feverishly, writing and selling 4 novels to publishers, successfully executing his plan. However, it turns out that the doctors were wrong. There never was a tumor. His frantic writing pace was unnecessary, only brought upon by the urgency of his imminent death. During the year of 1959 to 1960, Anthony Burgess wrote The Doctor is Sick in 1960, Inside Mr. Enderby, 1963, The Worm and the Ring, 1961, The Wanting Seed, 1962, and One Hand Clapping, 1961. He would later produce his most well-known work, A Clockwork Orange, which would be immortalized in film by Stanley Kubrick. In later years, Burgess referred to this prolific period as his terminal year because he was writing against the clock, knowing he was about to die. Despite his false diagnosis, he lived to age 76 and eventually succumbed in 1993. It's amazing what we can accomplish when we believe we are running out of time. The ironic thing is, we are. Every single one of us has a finite number of days on this planet, and each new day means that we are getting closer to our inevitable end. I don't say this to depress you, but rather to instill a sense of urgency about how you approach your days. If you knew that you had exactly 1 year left on this planet, what would you do? And why aren't you doing it? To be fair, we have to behave responsibly and with an eye on the future, which is why I despise the advice, live each day like it's your last. However, as you consider your ideas, your dreams, your relationships, your ambitions, which of them are you deferring action on until a more convenient time? In truth, that time may never come. I encourage you to consider the next year of your life a terminal year. What if you knew that on this date, 1 year from today, you would be dead? How would it change the way you approach your relationships, your work, your friendships, and the kinds of decisions you make every day? Would it cause you to behave more bravely? Would it help you to connect to what really matters? Might it open your eyes to ways in which you are deferring your ambitions? Here's a short 15-minute exercise that might help you gain some clarity. Number one, take out a piece of paper and at the top, write the date 1 year from today. Two, spend about 10 minutes considering what you'd like to be different on that date. How will you have changed? Who will you have impacted? What will you have built? Three, now cross out anything that is outside of your sphere of influence. Don't focus on what you can't control. Number four, with the remaining items, write one small action step that you can take in the next week to begin you on the journey of accomplishing it. The key is to make it small. It should almost feel easy. Number five, keep this list with you. When you take your small step, write another one down, then do it. Yes, this almost sounds too easy and simplistic. However, every great accomplishment occurs through small, measured progress made with urgency and diligence. One, that's the number of days you are given. Today is that day. Tomorrow is still to be determined. Yet we spend so much time worrying about things that are still in flux that we may have no influence over. We waste mental cycles catastrophizing and allowing fear to run rampant. We become paralyzed with inaction because we are afraid of getting it wrong and the implications that could have on our future. Because we are terrified of what might happen, we lose sight of our agency to make things happen through brave action. We lose sight of all that we've accomplished until now and the skills and platform we've developed that uniquely positions us to affect the change we desire. You will get it wrong. That's a certainty. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when and to what degree. But being wrong is of no importance, really. Right or wrong isn't what separates brilliant achievers from the rest. It's their willingness to adjust, adapt, and bravely move forward in the face of setbacks. It's their courage to ride the waves of uncertainty rather than being overcome by them. Don't fear wrong action, fear inaction. Stagnancy is the specter that should keep you awake at night more than any other. One small step in the face of fear is enough to dispel its hold on you. Regular, measured steps in the direction of your optimistic vision is sufficient to generate unstoppable momentum. When your big breakthrough comes, it probably won't feel momentous. Rather, it will seem like the next logical step in a long chain of brave actions. Success comes in layers and is earned through consistency. Consistency breeds confidence, which breeds courage. And consistency begins with a choice to show up and seize the moment. So, what will you do with your one day? What small, brave actions will you choose? Will you choose to be a reconciler of relationships by forgiving instead of assigning blame? Will you choose to share your idea with your manager instead of giving in to fear of ridicule? Will you choose to make something, anything, that moves you closer to your long-deferred ambition instead of saying, someday I'll? Will you choose to approach that client who seems out of reach instead of falling prey to imposter syndrome? Each of these choices and thousands of others in your life are singular moments in time that establish a new vector for you. What you choose to do with them will ultimately determine whether you build a body of work you can point to with pride or one which reflects your complacency, fear, and lack of nerve. I cannot emphasize enough how urgent this day is for you. You must treat it like your only valuable asset because it is. And within that precious day is a singular moment for you to seize. What is it and what will you do with it? Be brave.